The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia. And we're streaming on WWDBAM.com. And we want to welcome you again to Boomer Generation Radio. A reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall, committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit them online at www.discoverkendall.org, and you can call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860. You can reach us on boomergenerationradio@gmail.com and our relatively new Facebook page, Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook, which is quietly growing, and we appreciate those of you who've clicked on and liked or whatever you, however you do that. That's something I still am learning about. We are welcoming to the studio here Stephanie Cohen. Hi, Stephanie. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks for having me.
And we want to talk a little bit about your personal journey, and really as a symbol of a lot of the journeys that baby boomers have taken and are in the process of taking. And I guarantee you probably right now some are contemplating taking. And that is a journey of, in many ways, transition and transformation. Transition from one stage of life, a career, and transforming in many ways your own soul and view of life. So that's really the theme that we want to pursue, because I know I've run into many, many people, many of our generation who, for a variety of reasons, sometimes because they had no choice and sometimes because they just felt it was need to change career paths. So you have moved from a law career in the law, various aspects of the law, to writing, published author, short stories, writing, getting this out around the country, really, and online around the world. So first of all, again, thank you for being with us. And let me jump right to the heart of the question, I guess. What made you, what was that journey, that moment, like when you decided at some point when you were in your previous incarnation that you wanted to change? What was it like? What happened?
Well, you know, first of all, let me say, I think it was, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to do a number of different things throughout my career. And I had a terrific run. I worked in law firms, strategic planning and marketing, for 10 years in law firms, and enjoyed that very much. And there came a point in time, I was actually pregnant with my third child, and I had worked through the early years with my first two children, and I thought I wanted to try something different. I wanted to see what it was like to be a stay-at-home mother for a little while. Mm-hmm. I wanted to pursue my writing, which had always been an interest and a passion, but I hadn't had the opportunity to do that outside of my career for the previous maybe 10 or 15 years. And the job I was working was coming to a natural conclusion. So it was sort of a soft slide into transitioning into something else.
Soft slide, I like that. Why writing as opposed to, let's say, electrical engineering?
Well, there are a lot of reasons.
Baseball. But let's forget that. But why writing? So was it something when you were growing up, something, you know, that touched you in writing? Or did you read a lot?
Well, I was a voracious reader, right, for sure. Most writers will tell you that they were always huge readers. You know, I never thought whether or not to write. I just did. It was something that sort of happened organically. It was something I always wanted to do more of, something I had done since I was a child. Mm-hmm. It was more for self-expression at that point and self-exploration. I did not think in those first years of writing that I would be putting together a collection of short stories as I'm doing now. I didn't think about sending my stories out for publication for maybe 10 years after I started writing them.
Really? 10 years?
Yeah.
So, and so in your writing, what, because writing is a very isolated, solitary thing to do. It's really you and the computer, and a room and your ideas and your imagination. Walk me through the process, and I'm going to ask you to just, we have some snippets of some of the material you've written and some of that's been published. But there may be some people out there saying, boy, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that. But what's it like to sit down? Where does that idea come from? Is it, you read a lot, you look around, you take stuff from your friends, from the world. Walk us through that process of creation.
You know, the process of creation, I guess, is different for everybody. And for each individual person, it may be different on any given day. And so that's how it works for me. I don't think about it very much. It sort of bubbles up, you know, and I'll tell people who ask that the heart behind my stories are things that just sort of come to me. They're images or themes. It turns out that almost all of my writing is about moments of transition, because really what compels me is what moves people,
mm-hmm.
what makes them recognize that they're in a particular moment that's significant, that's meaningful for some reason or another. And separate from that actual event, how are they going to feel about it afterward? How does this change their life in some way that they may or may not have anticipated?
So one of the stories that you have a little snippet from one of the first transitions that we were talking about, the transition from into motherhood.
Yeah. So this is something I wrote a number of years ago. It's a short piece called Surrender, having to do with what it really feels like on a core spiritual level to become a mother in that moment of transition, particularly poignant for me today as it's my eldest daughter's birthday.
Jess. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Jess.
So go ahead.
So this is Surrender. It was originally published in Green Hills Literary Lantern. In childbirth, the final stage of labor before pushing out the baby is called transition. You get to the point where your contractions are so bad, intense, they call it, or productive, that you realize you are completely at the mercy of some higher power. Nature, biology, God, hell, call it what you want. There is no rest for the weary, no time to breathe, no turning back. The baby is moving down and out, and you are moving forward, fast forward, into some unknowable place where you will reside forever. In the instant the child is born, you will be transformed. No longer will your own being, your own survival, take priority. You will be ancillary. Whether you believe life begins at conception or viability or the moment of birth, there is something shockingly magical about that moment of arrival. There is, in fact, a brief time when a baby is half inside the mother and half outside. That combined creature should have a name, like a centaur or a mermaid. Mother with child, about to release child, about to let go for the very first time, the first of many a letting go. While that time of fused existence is short, its significance is stunning. A baby is present. A mother has been made, yet the two still coexist as one. Corded together, they exchange blood and breath. When the baby is ready, on the baby's own time frame and not the mother's, it opens its mouth and takes its first gulp of life. Only then is the cord severed and tied. As the months pass, it may feel as though life's breath is still shared. The child may seek its mother, and for even longer, the mother may seek the child, seek to regain the joint force of life, the oneness and connectedness that is in one moment so complete and in the next moment illusory.
Thank you. Transition. You talked about it. That was, and as you said, that's a theme, and it is because I've read some of the stuff, a theme. Talk to me a little bit about, in your understanding and your working through these themes in your life and your writings, the role of fear in transition. And why so many people who will say to you, I'm sure you've had this conversation with friends, I wish I had the courage, but I'm afraid. And then they fill in the blanks, even if they don't use the word fear. How did you deal with that?
You know, it's true. This is scary stuff. You know, writing is very scary because you put your heart on the page, you put your soul on the page. And then if you choose to expose your writing to other people, to other readers, you're really out there raw and naked for people to see.
It's an act of faith, isn't it?
It is an act of faith. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard the expression that you can really only act from one of two places, from love or from fear.
Mm.
And so, you know, I guess what I try to do is act out of love, not out of fear. And the reason that I write is to connect with other people. So that's all about love. That's all about touching somebody in a way that has significance for them, in a way that makes them feel... yes, other people have that feeling too. Other people know how how it feels to be vulnerable or scared or unloved, you know, and that commonality brings us together and maybe softens those feelings a little bit.
Is love and fear just two sides of the same coin?
Maybe. I think I'd have to think about that. Certainly, they're the two different motivators, I think, that drive a lot of what people do.
Certainly in writing, I mean, in some of your writing that I remember just reading, that those two emotions are present.
Yeah, I think they're present not only in the writing, but for all of us every day. In every moment, we have the opportunity to choose what to do next, whether it's a large transition, like a career change, or a marriage or a divorce, or moving across the country to try something new, you know, or a small moment, a small decision. Make lots of those on a daily basis. You know, if we avoid fear, maybe we make the better decisions, the more heartfelt decisions.
You have your website. So as we continue, somebody wants to read or get in touch with you. What's the website? How do they do that, Steph?
Anyone can go to my website at StephanieLevineCohen.com, and that's Stephanie with an F, Stefanie LevineCohen.com. And I have the stories I've published up on that site, as well as a blog, and I love to get comments, love to interact with people, love to hear what they think about the stories.
We're speaking with Stephanie Cohen, transition expert, author of short stories dealing with the human emotions of transition and fear and love, and really telling that story of a symbol of really moving from having the courage to move from one stage of life and career into really following one's passion or bliss, or whatever the current word is today. But you're also, you alluded to the fact that it's your eldest daughter's birthday. You have two other lovely daughters, a great husband. And so you're trying to carve out this new role for yourself and still juggling the, quote, normal, unquote, wife, daughter, mom. How was that? How much fear was involved with that?
Well, I'm tremendously fortunate to have a lot of support. You know, as you mentioned, I have a fabulous family, a wonderful husband, three kids, wonderful parents and extended family. That makes a very big difference. I don't feel alone. I very rarely feel alone, although, as you mentioned, writing is very solitary. I've had a great writers group and friends who are very supportive of the work. If I didn't spend most of my time engaging with my family, engaging with my friends, doing my community service and engagement work, which includes hospice and synagogue work at Makor Shalom, and also Haddonfield, also Morristown Friends School, where my children have attended, if I didn't do all that, I'd have nothing to write about.
Mm-hmm.
It's those moments of connection with other people and really the one-on-one interactions that feed the writing.
What's this, the mythology, or maybe it's not a mythology, write what you know? How did that fit into what you're, because the short story medium is its own particular genre, I would imagine. I know very little about this. So writing what you know, is this really all the stuff that you're writing about, and I want to go to another selection in a minute, really based upon all these relationships and experiences that you've had?
You know, a question that I'm asked frequently is how much of your stories is true.
Mm-hmm.
I have a blog post about that on the website for anyone who wants to read it. But really, I think for my stories anyway, the facts, the plot, those are not necessarily true. But the emotion in each story is very true.
Mm-hmm.
The psychological truth, the spiritual truth, that's what makes the story real. That's what makes it, I hope, resonate for readers.
There's a spiritual element in your stuff, isn't there?
There's a strong spiritual element in my writing. I'm very interested in the way our day-to-day lives intersect with our spiritual missions, goals, the roles, the reasons we feel we're here on Earth. And I think sometimes our everyday lives and our spiritual missions bump up against one another, and that's something I explore in my stories.
Do you find people are kind of like hesitant to deal in that spiritual aspect of their lives?
Is that another fear thing? I think people have varying levels of comfort with that, varying levels of belief in a spiritual world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it was one of the shows we just did with Elaine Portner, a medium in southern New Jersey. We talked a little bit about that as well. In fact, that show's now up on the web, my website, as a podcast, JewishSacredAging.com. But she also mentioned that, you know, we got into a little bit of this about some people's hesitancy to even dip your toe into that water. You mentioned a writer's group. How important is that writer's group?
Oh, huge. You know, I've been very fortunate for many years. I've been a member of the Rittenhouse Writers Group, which was founded by James Rahn, who's the founder and facilitator of that group. We think it's the longest running fiction writers workshop in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Without that network of supportive fellow writers, teachers, it would be very hard to get through the process.
You're listening to Boomer Generation Radio, a reminder here on WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia, streaming live on WWDBAM.com, and a reminder that Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Their mission and reason is together transform the experience of aging, and we invite you again to learn more about Kendall with a 1L on www.discoverkendall.org and toll free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. One of the stories that I remember, because I think I posted one of these on JewishSacredAging.com, which got a huge response, as was Lucky Lady. So give us a little background of Lucky Lady and perhaps a paragraph about Lucky Lady.
Okay, sure. Thanks. Lucky Lady is a story about a main character, Nettie, who is a widow. She has suffered a physical injury, and as she recovers, she's considering the passage of time as well as her own mortality. In this short section, which I'll read for you, Nettie's commenting on aging without her husband, Eddie, who has died 15 years earlier. When we raised our own kids, we measured time in their milestones. They sat up, they walked, they went to kindergarten. They rode bikes and passed from grade to grade until one day they graduated and went on to make their own lives. Even though we got older, the timeline wasn't about us, it was about them. Time is completely different with the grandchildren. Every one of their milestones would race against whatever time we have left. We were so grateful to see them born, to see them play and run. But they grew strong as we grew weak. They learned things we didn't even know existed. It was fine when Eddie and I did this together, but once he died, it was only me getting old, because Eddie, he didn't get that chance. And as for me, I didn't want them to see my weakness, so I pretended to be young and strong, just like they were. For a long time, we all believed it, too.
Stephanie, thank you. As you touch on the issue of just one's own aging and perceptions of the eyes that you look through, see the world through as we change and as life changes. So just on a personal level, walk me through how do you see your own writing and perceptions have changed from the time you started this to where you are now, and even speculate as to, you know, as your children get older, as this last one gets almost sooner getting ready to leave also for college, where you see that next perception, your eyes looking to the future and changing. How's all of that affected your writing? How's it changed?
Well, when I first started writing, I think this may be true of other writers who are very early in their career as well, I wrote mainly from my own perspective. I have a novel that sits in the drawer like many novelists do, which is very much from the point of view of a character like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And as my writing developed and as I got older and as I got to see more people at more stages of life, I started to write more from the perspective of characters at different stages, at different transitions and facing different challenges. So I think that my personal maturing sort of fed the maturing of the writing as well, so that now many of my stories, including the snippet I just read for you, they take place from the perspective of a character who's maybe much older than I am, or not my gender,
mm-hmm.
or not my situation in life. But the underlying emotions and the fears and the loves, I think those are universal.
Mm-hmm. Is it different? You mentioned gender, just as an aside. Do you find it easier to write as a woman, or is it the challenge of writing from a male perspective? Walk us through a little bit of that challenge.
I don't think it's – most of my stories are from the perspective of women, but not all of them. And, in fact, my first really successful short story has a male protagonist who's going through a divorce, and I'm neither male nor divorced.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a question of getting inside the heart of the character and imagining what you think their feelings and their spirit would be in a situation.
So, again, it's we're back to that theme of transition, personal transition, physical transition, spiritual transition. Somebody may be sitting there listening either now or on one of the podcasts or the streaming and say, I want to do this. How difficult was it to get started? I mean, did you send out, like they do in the movies, 500 stories and wait for the letters to come back? Do you pound the, you know, knock on doors of people? How do you do that in this day of electronics and everything?
It's really hard. It's really hard, and it can be very sobering. You know, the statistics I've heard are that to get a short story published, one has to send out stories to maybe 100 different publications before getting one picked up. Those aren't good odds.
No, it's like the Phillies batting average.
No, but it's like anything else. Persistence is key, and there are moments that are somewhat depressing. But, you know, if you want to get your work out there, and if you want to share what it is that you have to say, your message, that's what you have to do. You just send it out. It's much easier in this electronic time where many publications are online publications.
Right.
In fact, all of my publications but for one are in electronic publications, and they're available not just through my website but archived on those literary journals' websites, which is great.
So you're doing a lot more of this electronic publishing. And again, your website is, in case somebody wanted to touch base with you or read more of these stories. So what is it?
That's StephanieLevineCohen.com.
It's slower and spell it out.
Okay. So it's Stefanie, Levine, Levine, Cohen, Cohen.com.
So the what piece of advice? This is a typical, you know, this typical question, but I think it's important because you really do represent a paradigm of what a lot of people, I think, would like to do. It's perseverance. It's not being afraid of rejection, and it's the ability to, follow that passion that's in you. And so, what with all that in mind, what one piece of advice would you give somebody who would really say, "Gee, I wish I had the courage to do that"?
You know, the first word that pops to my mind when you ask me that question is the word trust.
Mm.
You need to trust yourself. You need to trust whatever you believe is the source that provides the inspiration. For some people, it's a muse. For some people, it's God. For some people, it's an inner self.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter what language you use to describe that. But that feeling of trusting that if you sit quietly and you're patient and you put your hours in with your fingers on the keyboard in front of that computer screen, it will come. Trust the emotion that comes out. Try not to let your head get too much in the way. There's plenty of time to bring that intellectual rigor back in the editing process, but not in the first draft. In the first draft, just let your heart flow out onto the page.
I have to ask you this too before we start running out of time, because I've talked to a number of people who write, and I know when I have written, it's like arduous. Do you sit down every day? Do you have a fixed time that you're not to be disturbed for the possibility of nuclear war? This is my time to write. Do you do that, or you just wait for the inspiration to come and do it then? What do you do?
I wish I could say that I have that much structure or that I'm that disciplined. I'm neither. I write when I can, and I have lots of time available to me, more than many people, but I'm just not that structured a person. It comes when it comes.
So this last bit that I want to invite you to share with us really speaks to again, a subject that we've touched on a little bit, of dealing with, cognitive impairment and loss of cognition and Alzheimer's and dementia and all this challenge that's confronting all of us. And I know you do work in some of these areas with Samaritan Hospice in Jersey. What's this little snippet? What's it from? And just a little bit of a background. And we have about 4 minutes left. So just walk us through this little piece.
This is a piece called Memory Wing. Largely inspired by my volunteering with Samaritan Hospice. The main character is a woman named Sylvia. She lives in the memory loss section of a skilled nursing facility. She tends to go in and out of awareness. The story is told from her point of view. We're inside her mind, which alternates between being clear and cloudy. And this comes toward the end of the piece. The names in the story, Lily and Jacob, are her relatives who've already died, and she's thinking about them. It is almost nighttime, and though I can't remember yesterday or the day before, I'm becoming clearer for right now. I feel stronger, but I know it will not last. Outside my cell, the sky is changing, gray with pink edges of light. Good girls do not get angry, Mama said, but I think sometimes they do. How else can I hold on to myself? I am a person, not a disease. My mind wanders, yes, but here I am. Talk to me like you remember me, even if I don't remember you. Don't shout at me. I am here. Sylvia is here. I know I am scaring you. I'm sorry for that. I don't mean to remind you of what scares you the most, of what you would be if this were you. But don't be frightened when I cry out. My words may fail, but this shattered voice is still mine. My weakened fist may shake, but I can still raise it just a bit. Once I was strong. I was proud. I loved. I was loved. I tried to be good, and sometimes I was, and sometimes I wasn't. I am human. This is what remains. Before the sun sets, let me remember who I am, who I am not, before I cannot say it anymore, not to you, not even to myself. The veil descends without warning. I will drift and return, drift and return. Let me be when I want to be. Let me sit where I want to sit, eat when I want to eat, dream, awaken, and dream again. Hold my hand. Let me feel the sunshine. Let me hear the birdies. Don't you see? I listen for Lily in their song, for Jacob in the flapping of their wings. I listen for the lion's roar. I keep watch for Sylvia.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie Cohen, for sharing with us your talent and your inspiration, and this whole idea of transitions and trust in oneself and the dichotomy and tension of love and fear and the ability to follow your own dream and passion. So thank you. Continued good luck. And before we leave you, the website again, in case somebody wants to read more of your stuff.
Thanks so much. That's Stephanie Levine Cohen, Stephanie with an F, levinecohen.com.
Stephanie Cohen, thank you very much. Continued good luck with this. Great writing, and wish you well. Wish you well, and happy birthday, Jess, and say hello to the rest of the family for me.
Thanks so much.
Okay. A reminder, you're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. Again, you can reach us on boomergenerationradio@gmail.com and go on our Facebook page. We appreciate doing that. Like it. And if you have a comment on anything we are doing or suggestions, Boomer Generation Radio on Facebook is the place to go. Before we move into our second segment, a couple of announcements that I want to bring to your attention. First of all, a reminder that there's a very, very interesting and not only worthwhile, but important conference coming up that is coming up on March 2nd and 3rd in Washington, D.C., sponsored by CTAC, the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care. It's really an opportunity for you to engage in a serious series of conversations with coalitions from around the United States of America on the increasing importance of advanced care, the funding of advanced care, the politics of advanced care, and the spirituality of advanced care. If you're all interested in this, you can get more information on the website at CTAC, and you can email one of the conference coordinators, Jackie, at jbuente, that's J-B-U-E-N-T-E, at thectac, T-H-E-C-TAC, C-T-A-C.org. Information there about the conference, registration. I really urge you, if you're all interested in this, we've done several programs on the whole issue of advanced care, and the issue continues to be one of extreme importance. And also a reminder from our friends at 50andbeyond.com, despite the fact that the groundhog sillily or sadly said that there's going to be more winter, all he had to really is look out the window. Many of us, many of you perhaps are thinking, well, spring should be here sooner or later, and it's time to start thinking about selling your home or downsize. 50andbeyond.com and Boomer Generation Radio are sponsoring a series of forums for baby boomers in the southern New Jersey area. The next workshop is going to be on Wednesday, February 25th, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Cherry Hill Library on King's Highway in Cherry Hill. It's there's a fee of $10 to cover some of the costs, to cover the light refreshments, etc. We're going to be discussing in this particular workshop the idea of selling your home, getting the most money for your home, how to remove the clutter from your home. You should see my place. And also tips on how to handle concerns about the hoarding. It's really a way, if you're thinking about in the springtime, selling, moving, downsizing, we're going to try to just deal with this from a comprehensive point of view with people who do this for a living. And that's February 25th, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Cherry Hill Library on King's Highway. It's one of our series of four forums. We did the first one on the Choice in Dying Bill. There'll be some others coming up later on in the spring. That's February 25th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. We'll be advertising more about that as we go along. And a reminder from Bethel Congregation in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, have asked me to remind you of their monthly singles service at 8 p.m. coming up on February 20th. It's at the third Friday of every month at the synagogue, which is at 8000 Main Street in Voorhees. And if you're interested in more information about this, let me suggest you call 856-662-7916. So welcome back to the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio, brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services advocating for and empowering older adults to reach their full potential. As we've been reminding you, Kendall is committed to together transform the experience of aging, and you can reach them on www.discoverkendall.org and toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. And through the magic of our producer, Tony, and electronics, we want to welcome to Boomer Generation Radio our second guest, Dr. Ellen Langer from Harvard. Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. First of all, how much snow did you? Were you able
too much
to maneuver?
It's 3 feet. And the show, I've got to figure out how to get my car out.
Well, I would tell you to try prayer, but it doesn't work with the... Well, congratulations. Do us a favor here in Philly. Enjoy the snow. Better you
okay
than us. Better. I'm not a big fan of snow or winter. Dr. Ellen Langer, professor at Harvard University, and we thank you for joining us here on Boomer Generation Radio to
about
mindfulness. You teach mindfulness at Harvard?
Yes, I do.
And this subject is really is fascinating to me. And I think, as I mentioned to you the other day on the phone, I keep running into it more and more in my own work, in the work that I do in speaking on older adult issues around the country, in the teaching I do. Walk me through a really nice, easy definition of mindfulness, because if you say it, most people say, oh, it's meditation. Is it meditation?
Yeah, no. I've been studying mindfulness without meditation for the last 40 years, and it's so simple it almost defies belief. All you need to do is actively notice new things. When you actively notice, what happens is it puts you in the present, which, by the way, everybody says you should be in the present, but when you tell someone to be in the present, it's basically an empty instruction, since when you're not there, you're not there to know you're not there. This is the way to be there. You simply notice. And when you notice, you come to see that the things you thought you knew well, you really don't know at all. You can't know them in any absolute way because everything is always changing. Everything looks different from different perspectives. So everything is new, and by noticing, you make it new for yourself. The process of noticing is the essence of engagement. So it feels good, and 40 years of research has made clear to me that it's literally and figuratively enlivening. So we make people, we instruct people on how to be more mindful. They live longer, they're happier, they're more engaged in what they're doing. The symptoms of many diseases diminish. It's really quite remarkable, actually, that you get so many positive outcomes from such a simple process.
Do I need to, you know, do I need to find myself a quiet space, a quiet turn the lights down, put on?
You know, meditation is fine. It's a practice that's engaged to result in post-meditative mindfulness. This is more direct, not better, not worse. It's just a different way of getting to the same place. And so what happens when you meditate is that thoughts come to your mind and you're supposed to treat them almost as if they're irrelevant or garbage. You just let them go. And in doing that, over time, what's supposed to happen is that you're not caught by the thoughts. You don't become reactive to them. In our approach, by directly attacking those thoughts and questioning how you can think that, be so sure that this or that is going to happen and so on, you end up also free from being reactive. So for stress, for instance, most of the world is suffers enormous stress, and stress is mindless. Stress comes about because of a view you take of an event. Events don't cause stress. So if you open up that view and look at it from, you know, more perspectives, it will diminish. Stress results from two beliefs. The first is something is going to happen, and second, that when it happens, it's going to be awful. Because everything is always changing and looks different from different perspectives, you can't know what's going to happen. So instead of being so sure that this negative thing is going to happen, if you simply ask yourself for evidence, suggesting that it might not happen. So we've just gone from it's definitely going to happen to maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. Now outcomes are again in our heads, not in the things we're evaluating. So when we look at this potential negative event, let's say it's going to happen. What are the advantages of it happening? And there are always advantages, disadvantages. It's simply a function of the way you look at things. So we went from this negative thing is definitely going to happen to this thing may or may not happen. And if it happens, I'll be fine because of all of these positive aspects of it.
So let me, in my work as a clergy person, you know, I've bumped into too many people who, to give you a perfect example, and I know mindfulness is used a lot in stress reduction.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come home from that doctor or they'll get that call with a very, very serious diagnosis that hits them out of the clear blue. And they'll immediately go to like DEFCON 3.
Right.
How am I going to deal with this?
Well, it's interesting because I have several things to say and written a great deal about disease. The first thing is that, oddly, there are many people who first come alive when they're given this dread diagnosis. You know, they realize that life isn't endless and that they better get themselves in shape and stop being concerned about petty things and so on. When we're given a diagnosis, there's a presumption that the medical world really knows that this is what we have and this is the course that the disease will take. And the medical world doesn't know that. The medical world is only dealing with probabilities. It can't be other than that. And it's also assumed that there's little we can do to help ourselves with these diseases. Well, we're doing work now. We've completed work with diabetes, arthritis. We're doing work with completed work with ALS. In progress, we have cancer, multiple sclerosis. We have lots of diseases that we're attacking with the assumption that we can exert enormous control over our health, that most people haven't even begun to realize. So I've been pursuing for the last, I guess since the late 70s, what I call this mind-body unity theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very simple idea. It says, you know, there's been a perennial problem called the mind-body problem. And what that is the question, how do you get from this fuzzy thing called the thought to the body, to something material? And everybody knows that one's thoughts affect one's body. You know, you're walking down the street and a leaf blows in your face, and before you realize it's a leaf, you become startled, your blood pressure increases, and so on. But by looking for how does this happen, we've gotten away from all the control that we can exercise over our health by just accepting that it happens. So I want to argue that mind, body, these are just words. And if we put them back together, then wherever you're putting the mind, you're necessarily putting the body. So we've done a host of studies where we put the mind in a healthy place, take the measurements from the body, and again, the results are very exciting. The first of these was a study that we call the counterclockwise study. Here we took seniors. These were men in their 80s. And that's when 80 was 80, not the new 60. I mean, they were old. And we had them live in a retreat for a week that had been retrofitted to 20 years earlier. They were going to live there as if it was, in fact, 20 years earlier, speaking about the past and the present tense and so on. And what we found was that by having their mind in this younger, we found that they looked younger, sorts of healthy behavior. We found that they looked younger, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength improved, and some of their cognitive abilities. So it was quite remarkable, and we've done that now in many studies. The most recent, for example, is with diabetes. Type 2 diabetics come in for the study. They sit in front of a computer. The computer has a clock on the lower right-hand corner. For a third of the people, the clock is running twice as fast as real. For a third of the people, it's running half as fast as real. And for a third, it's real time. And the question we were asking was, does blood sugar level follow real or perceived time? And you can see from this mind-body unity, the expectation is our perceptions rule. And that's, in fact, what we found. So there are basically two different strategies we've used in looking at disease to find how much control we actually can, again, exploit and use to heal ourselves. One is this counterclockwise idea. We put the mind in a place, take the measurements from the body. That explains spontaneous remissions, placebos, and things of that sort. The other is based on what we call attention to variability. And that's just a code word for being mindful, noticing change. So what happens is, as you said, you go to the doctor, you're given a diagnosis, you give up. If instead what you did was pay attention to the subtle changes in your symptoms, nothing stays the same. Sometimes it's a little better, sometimes it's a little worse. If you do that, what happens is, first you notice, gee, now it is a little better, let's say, or a little worse, and you ask yourself why. What that does is instigate a mindful search for the answer. Now, in all the research I alluded to before, simply asking those questions turns out to be good for your health.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask the question, you may also come up with a solution. So we have lots of studies where we have people with different diseases attending to the variability in their symptoms, and it seems to result in health improvements. One that we completed, not about disease, but was with pregnant women who were in their, I think it was their fifth month of pregnancy, and we had them attend to the variability of the sensations they experienced. And what happened in doing so, they ended up with healthier newborns.
We're speaking with Dr. Ellen Langer, professor at Harvard University, talking about this expanding field and of research into mindfulness and the impact of mindfulness right now, as Dr. Langer was explaining to us, on health. A reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall Outreach, serving the field of aging by raising public awareness and advocacy around important issues of older adults. Through education and training in comprehensive, safe, and individualized long-term care practices, Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approach to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. To learn more, we invite you to visit Kendall.org. That's 1L, K-E-N-D-A-L.org. And when you get there, click on the Outreach icon. That's Kendall Outreach. Dr. Ellen Langer here on Boomer Generation Radio, WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley, streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And a reminder that you can reach the show on Boomer Generation Radio at gmail.com and on our relatively new Boomer Generation Radio Facebook page. Dr. Langer, there seems to be an increase, as you're pointing out in your research, in awareness and concern and use of mindfulness. In your research and your experience, is there any relationship in this growth in popularity between the expanding of the baby boomers?
Oh, I think for sure.
And our desire perhaps to see another avenue to seek meaning in our own life?
Yes. I think that as a baby boomer myself, my whole life was characterized by change. You know, there were so many of us that the high school had to build a new addition, and everything changed. And I think that with people living longer, the baby boomer is caught in a way by having adult children, but also having very old parents to take care of. And since we were always a generation that wasn't going to accept things as they were, if they if they weren't good, we'd look at our parents and say, no, we don't want that for ourselves. And then people go about trying to change it and look for solutions all over the place. I mean, the work that I've been doing started in the early 70s, where I gave plants and mindful decisions to people in nursing homes and found that they live longer. And so for me, from that time on, it was always clear that we had enormous control over our health. And it was for me trying to figure out how to harness that. Everybody's always known about placebos, and that always struck me as strange, that you would have to go to a doctor to give you a pill that's inert by definition. It's just a sugar pill or whatever. It's not real medicine. You would take it, and then you'd heal. And for me, the question was, well, why do we need the charade? Why don't we figure out how to do it more directly? And that's what I've devoted most of my life to. And as you said, that because the baby boomers are in such large numbers, and at that point in life where they say, okay, they've had their kids, they've gotten to typically wherever they're going to get to with their jobs, now is the time for them to pay a different kind of attention to themselves and to figure out how to remain healthy and fully alive. So everybody, you can't open a magazine now without people talking about mindfulness,
right,
which for me is very exciting.
So, I mean, is what you're saying, in especially relatable to our generation, is the practice of mindfulness?
Mindfulness, as I study, it isn't a practice.
Okay.
It's a way of being. You know, a practice is something where you take yourself outside of what you might otherwise be doing, and you do this thing, even if it's practicing scales on a piano, getting ready for some ultimate concert or performance or what have you.
So that's
this is every day.
That's
every
very important.
Moment.
So you're making the difference between a practice of mindfulness and mindfulness as a lifestyle. Is that
exactly
correct?
And when you realize that it's energy begetting, it's what you're doing when you're traveling. You know, when we get on a plane and we pay a lot of money to take a vacation, we have this expectation that we're going to see new things. And because we expect to see new things, we see new things, and it's exhilarating. And, you know, we have to realize, though, that everything at home is also brand new. And so that feeling of excitement when you travel or when you're at play you're still learning new things. You don't call it learning because learning has gotten a bad name. So you can see that it's an easy thing to do. It's, as I said, good for you physically, psychologically. It's good for your relationships. There, over 40 years, I've had a lot of time to measure different things. And so we make people more mindful. We find out their relationships are better. Mm-hmm. We make people more mindful. They're more charismatic. We make people more mindful. They live longer. And so on and so on. Somebody the other day asked me something which, you know, made me unhappy, which is, you know, there's always sort of a backlash.
Right.
So this person said, well, since everybody now is talking about mindfulness, is it a fad? And I thought, what, you know, you're going to call this wonderful way of being like the hula hoop? And I said, explain that if you're making toast every day, and every day you burn the toast, and someone comes and shows you how easy it is to make the toast without burning it, you're not going to go back to burning it. You're going to continue doing what feels good. And this mindfulness feels good. You know, you want to be alive. Mm-hmm. Right now, most people, sadly, are sealed in unlived lives, acting like robots. Fear, you know, afraid of many things that, you know, is more than just irrational. I think for me, it's important to understand that life only consists of moments. And so you want to make those moments matter. And our mindlessness prevents that.
Is mindfulness this lifestyle choice, a way of really exercising and grabbing control over one's life?
Yeah, what ends up happening is when you're more mindful, you have more control because you're not reactive to mindlessly understood outcomes. You know, right now for a lot of people, if it's good, you feel you have to have it. If it's bad, you feel you have to stay away from it. If you're mindful and you recognize that it itself is neither good nor bad, it allows you just to be.
Mm-hmm. Do I need a teacher to teach me how to do this?
You know, I'm a teacher, so it's good to have a teacher, but no, not in the way that I think you mean it.
Right, right.
No, no, all you need to do is notice new things, recognize. If you had just one mindset, and it's the only mindset I think that one should have, it's a mindset for uncertainty. Uncertainty is real. That when we think we know something, we're confusing our mindsets with what's really going on. Things are changing. You want to hold it still in your head, hold it still. But in doing so, you give up control. And once you recognize that the outcomes you fear are of your own making, you don't need to have all of that worry. And you end up then feeling more in control, less pulled again by circumstances.
If somebody wanted to learn more about this lifestyle change and choice, where would you direct them to go? Websites, books?
Yeah,
your
well,
stuff,
I've
your...
written 5 books on the topic. We just came out with a 25-year anniversary edition of Mindfulness. That would be a good place to start. And my books and work can be found on 2 of my websites, but the one that it's probably most exciting at the moment is the Langer Mindfulness Institute, where what we've done now, we're in countries all over the world teaching people to be more mindful.
So
people can go to that website, Langer Mindfulness Institute,
and read all about it. Is that a .com or?
.com, yes.
Okay.
Excuse me.
So just for the sake of clarity, spell it. L-A-N-G-E-R Mindfulness.
MindfulnessIndfulness Institute. INSTITUTE.
Just one continuous.
Com.
One continuous. No spaces.
One word.
Right. Right. Okay.
Several words combined as one.
And your books on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, the usual.
Yeah, and also listed on the website. And the other website is just ellenlanger.com.
Mm-hmm. So are you finding now, I think I mentioned this to you on the phone the other day when we just talked a little bit before the show, One of the journals that I get, and actually I used this yesterday in the class in the seminary to tell my students about the use of mind. There's a whole issue of the Family Therapy Network on the use of mindfulness in therapy and in ritual. Are you seeing this just go wild through various professions?
Oh, yes. Now, I think that if you recognize that no matter what you're doing, you're doing it either mindfully or mindlessly. And when you're doing it mindfully, that's where all the payoffs are. So it doesn't matter what your profession, if you did it mindfully, you'd reap all sorts of rewards.
So we have about 2 minutes left in this segment before we have to say goodbye. And again, thank you very much for joining us here. And a reminder to our audience that Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, that system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states. And again, the website is that you want to go to is discoverkendall.org, and the toll-free number is 888-759-0128. Dr. Langer, to use an image from the work that I do and my tradition and my calling as a clergy person, and I think you alluded to this, we meet a lot of people who spend their lives in exile. Their souls are in exile. And in other words, this lifestyle choice that you're teaching and live, is it a way to bring a soul out from back from exile into reality and to basically give blessings to being alive and to appreciate every day and every moment and every life?
Well, given that when you're mindful, you are feeling in a way that is similar to being spiritual. You're not burdened with stress. You're feeling competent and effective. It's easy to then be generous to all the people around you because you have so much to give. So, yes, I agree with you.
So we have 2 minutes left, according to Tony. Mindfulness, just in case people think that this is some new age, new invention.
No,
old. It's just been around for years, right?
Yeah. No, I started studying mindfulness from this Western scientific perspective back in the 70s. So it's not new age, but we don't have to mindlessly put down new age. I mean, I'm sure there are things in new age that will eventually become part of old age.
Yeah, well, one hopes. And the danger also, as you alluded to in this half hour, there is a danger in labeling things just for the sake of labeling things, because I guess the labeling automatically triggers other reactions and emotions rather than just being in.
Exactly. So if we took anything we labeled and asked ourselves how else might we frame it, we'd come to see that, again, this thing that we thought we knew can be brand new for us. Same thing with people. You know, you see somebody in a particular way, then what happens is you expect them to be that way, and we always find evidence for our expectations. If we simply expected them not to be that way, we'd also find evidence.
So mindfulness, again, this lifestyle choice. Dr. Ellen Langer, for professor at Harvard University, we're just about out of time. Hey, thank you very, very much for sharing your wisdom, your research, your knowledge, and your insights about this very, very exciting phenomenon and choice. And thank you much. We wish you good luck. And
my
again,
pleasure.
LangerInMindfulInstitute.com. That's how you can get in touch with what Dr. Langer is talking about. To all of you, have a great week. We'll see you back next week on Boomer Generation Radio. Take care. Thank you, Dr. Langer.
Be well.